Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and we welcome you to a slightly shorter week for The Daily Friend, as we won't be having an episode on Thursday, because it is, of course, Heritage Day, and we hope that everyone will be enjoying their slightly shorter week. I am joined today by Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you doing this fine Monday?
All right, yourself, Mr. Lorimer.
I'm doing all right. All right, as one can do for a Monday, I suppose. And Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this fine Monday?
I'm okay, although Monday is always a slightly blue day, I suppose.
Yes. No, it's even for a short week, it's a bit grim because then you just are looking forward to the end. Anyway, let us boldly search
forward to the end.
Let us boldly surge towards our topics of discussion today. And the first is, this statement was released actually on the 8th of September, but it's sort of been kicking about the media space for a little while now. And this is a directive from all governments to enroll all public servants in compulsory ethics courses. Public Service and Administration Minister Senzo Machuno has directed government departments to ensure that officials enroll for compulsory ethics and public services online courses offered by the National School of Government. This is part of a compulsory suite of courses seeking to professionalize the public service, as announced by Cyril Ramaphosa in his 2019 State of the Nation address. Ethical conduct and organizational integrity are key to eradicate fraud and corruption in the public service and administration, the statement says. As the training arm of government, it is therefore imperative that National School of Government implements a training program that will equip public officials with the skills and competencies to make ethical decisions, to develop organizational integrity, to prevent fraud and combat corruption in the public sector. More specifically, the content of the courses will enable officials to reflect on their own values and behavior in the workplace, recognize common areas of ethical dilemmas and public service employees, apply the core ethical values and standard contained in proscripts, which have relevance with the conduct of employees in public service, and uphold and promote professional ethics in the workplace. Terence, what should we make of this? Is this something to be lauded, or is this not exactly what we need right now?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. I think that something like this can be useful. There are ethics courses that are taught in universities around the world for business people and for government officials. I think that South Africa would probably be in very good company if it were to do this. The problem is that ethics and morality are something that has to arise from within. Ultimately, it's experiential. If you enter an organization in which the culture and the standard of behavior, the bar for the standard of behavior is set very high, people will adapt to that. If you are in an environment of chaos where people are able to get away with it, you are simply going to have more of it. Now, I like the phrase the professionalization of the civil service. That has been, I think, the single biggest failure of South Africa post 1994, the inability to build a professional civil service. There are pockets of excellence, and there are pockets, more than pockets. There are in some instances valleys full of incompetence, and just turning the state into a piggy bank and place for sheltered employment. And a lot of this, it must be borne in mind, was not simply inheritance, although that was part of it, but it was a decision in 1997 by the ANC to consciously politicize the civil service. What we are seeing now is the absolute predictable outcome of it. So it's all very well to have courses and to help people to reflect in their own conduct, which is well and good. But as I say, a fish rots from the head. If while we're doing this, the ruling party can, you know, still talks about cadre deployment and, you know, getting its own people in the right positions, and you will simply never allow that professional culture to take root. I always like to refer back to an article I read on Time Magazine's archives. It was written in reference to South Africa in the early 60s, and saying that if you look at comparative post-colonial societies like Nigeria, and remember this is the sort of early to mid 60s. This is a country that has chronic political instability, but an excellent civil service that's able to hold the country together. Well, no one would say that about Nigeria. Now, once you are in that groove, it is very, very hard to get out of.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the problems with this program, you know, apart from the ones that you mentioned about how government leaders are setting a bad example, and there's a sort of general culture of corruption. Is that there's a sort of belief that we can, you know, a lot of problems in South Africa, some people believe if you just change one law, implement one policy, or, you know, hold some courses, you can sort of direct everything correctly, as though the only reason we have any problems is sort of a lack of information. Marius, what do you make of this? Is this, do you think part of that trend? Do you think I'm right about that?
Yeah, I think so. And it's also just, I mean, it's cosmetic. If the government wanted to get rid of corruption, it'd be quite easy. Just, enforce the laws that already exist. If somebody gets found guilty of corruption, you know, they need, depending on how bad it is, obviously, they need to go to jail or, you know, get fired or whatever the case is. But we've seen this hardly ever happens. And when senior ANC officials are found guilty of corruption, which doesn't happen very often, they're often lauded as heroes. I mean, somebody like Tony Ngeni comes to mind, where he was, you know, basically carried on the shoulders of his colleagues into the gates of the prison. And Dile Lungisa, he wasn't guilty of corruption, but he was found guilty of criminal act now recently, also went to jail. And we've seen he's had support from some senior officials in the ANC, like Mzwandile Masina, who's the mayor of Ekurhuleni, for example.
And so like Ngeni, he also had a crowd to welcome him to prison, exactly. And cheer him on.
And he said, I mean, and also claimed it's all, a plot against him and a conspiracy, even though there's video evidence of him smashing a jug over somebody's head. And he claimed the video was doctored by the evil whites, obviously. So that's quite interesting. But I think that's, you can have as many courses and stuff as you want. But until you actually sending people to jail for wrongdoing, it's not really going to make much difference. And I'm not sure why you need a course to say don't steal or don't be corrupt. I mean, this is something that's, you know, but people do it in general because they get away with it. It's the same as the arguments against the death penalty. The death penalty itself is not a deterrent against crime. What is a deterrent is being caught and going to jail. So that's the issue. We need that. Like I said, we don't even need any new laws or anything like that. Just enforce the ones that exist and, you know, send people to jail for wrongdoing. And then you'll see the number of people who are who do things that are, you know, not really above board. I would imagine the number would drop significantly. And this is all stuff that's quite easy to do. It just takes political will from the government and from the ANC. But until we get there, it'll just be this cosmetic kind of shifting deck chairs in the Titanic.
Yeah, I think I disagree with that a little bit in that I think that it isn't necessarily that easy to do. I think it's easy to know where to start. I think you're definitely right about that. But I think that something like a culture of corruption is actually quite difficult to get rid of. It can sort of linger for a long time. But you at least have to start rooting it out, which is something we haven't done particularly well at all. Have you got something to say, Maurice?
No.
Okay, sorry. I thought you were going to interject there. I guess my point I was trying to make at the beginning of my question to you, and I also ask you about this, Terence, is I think that there's a sort of technocratic approach here that a lot of people see South Africa's government as we can just implement, you know, a technocratic vision of government and everything can be done by checking boxes and having an efficient bureaucracy. But I think we're in such a bad state institutionally that that's not really a solution. Am I right about that, Terence? I mean, should we look at things, at least in the short term, that don't involve too much government action?
Well, I think that that's true. What's caused this, though, I think, is fundamentally been political decisions. You know, I remember in the throughout most of the Mbeki era, there was the country was very upbeat, and you know, there was a lot of academic and popular writing about South Africa's challenges. We didn't have problems; we had challenges. A lot of this, there was this assumption that, you know, there was a great deal of competence, and you know, we just needed to sort of hit on the right formula. But we were kind of getting there. But I think that what was happening in the background was that things were steadily eroding. You know, already in the late 1990s, early 2000s, you would see reports about municipalities that have no one who can prepare accounts, or there's no engineers to deal with the water supply, etc. And that just sort of carried on. You know, you had public service standards for employment, which imposed all sorts of restrictions, but also, you know, created enormous incentives for playing patronage, because, you know, well-paying secure jobs. You had a conscious politicization. Now, technocratic solutions are great, and we need them, and we need more accountants and engineers and whatever, and we need proper systems that encourage reporting. But that all has to fit onto a culture that is compatible with it. I think, you know, once you have that culture right, that's 90% of your battle won. It sort of starts to just be the way things are done, the way things that things are organized out of instinct and out of moral assumptions. But I think that now civil service has gone badly wrong. So those technocratic solutions are probably not going to succeed, because people who go in there with the expectation that they're coming into institutions that are compromised, but where there is fundamentally a will to correct them, you know, run up against a reality that will is often not there. In fact, they're perverse incentives, and you know, someone wanting to do the right thing is seen as a threat. So no, you know, until we're willing to solve those political and those institutional culture issues, I don't think we're going to get off the runway.
Very correct, I think. All right, let's move overseas to talk about Thailand. Now, actually, you know, I don't think a lot of people think of Thailand as a big player in international affairs, but it is, in purchasing power parity terms, the 20th biggest economy in the world. It's got a population a little bit bigger than South Africa, so I think it's about sort of 70, 80 million people, so a bit bigger than ours. And of course, it's a big tourist destination for many people, including many South Africans. And it has rather complicated politics. For years, it's sort of surged between democracy and military rule. And recently, it's seen an entrenchment of the power of the monarchy. The current Thai constitution, which is, I think, their 20th constitution, it basically says that no one can insult the king. So even though the king is only supposed to be a constitutional figurehead, one can get almost 15 years in prison or longer for every single time that you're found to be making any kind of accusation or slight against the monarch. And there are now protests in Thailand calling for a reform of the monarchy. And most recently, the protesters placed a plaque in a government square declaring that Thailand belongs to the people and not the king. And this has now been removed overnight by someone, we're not clear who. It could be the police, it could be someone else. So it looks the protests are ongoing. They gave a 10-point plan for reform in Thailand and to its monarchy specifically in August. Marius, what do we make of this? Do you think the Thais will be able to make any headway here? Marius, I think you are muted, sir.
Oh, hello there. Can you hear me? Back, sorry.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, there's some the quite strong laws against insulting the monarchy or the king in Thailand. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's Lese Majeste laws, Lese Majeste laws, which make it a criminal offence to, you know, criticise the king or the monarchy. And this is what a lot of people are pushing back against in Thailand, especially younger people. I think also part of the problem is that the Thailand is a newish king. I think it was his coronation last year, the year before. His regal name is Ramaten. I don't know what his official Thai name is. Quite a long name. I won't try to pronounce it. But he succeeded his father, King Bhumibol, who was actually the second longest serving monarch in recorded human history. So he was a well-loved figure. He was very well respected by the Thai people. But his son seems to lack quite a lot of that gravitas. I remember I saw photos of when King Bhumibol died and his son came back to Thailand, because he actually lives in Germany most of the time. And he arrived there on the runway in Bangkok. You know, his father's died, supposed to be a somber occasion. And he's walking around with this tight white vest on and his tight jeans. And you can see this massive back tattoo that the guy has. And also the videos came out of he threw a birthday party for his poodle, and these videos came out of the king or now the king who's the king now walking around in a g-string, just a g-string, and he's throwing this massive party for his dog, which I mean, I don't think there's anything really wrong with throwing a party for your dog if you want, but I do think you do expect the king to have some kinds of levels of gravitas and dignity, and I think that's probably part of the problems with this king. And who knows if he was a bit more dignified and so on, if they would be seeing these kind of protests in Thailand. But as you also mentioned, Thailand's got some interesting politics at the moment. It's always swinging through from being a junta to being a democracy. But there's been some sinister things happening in Thailand. People have been disappearing. An activist against the monarchy was grabbed off the streets of Cambodia, apparently, and bundled off to who knows where. So there's some concerning things coming from Thailand, which is actually, to a degree, it's been actually a bulwark of stability in Southeast Asia, especially, for years, and even during the Cold War, when there was, all kinds of proxy wars and fighting in Southeast Asia, especially in Cambodia and Vietnam. Thailand was always kind of an ally of the West and, a stable oasis in what was quite an unstable region. So this is all quite concerning, and we'll have to see what happens. So, I mean, I don't think we'll see the King of Thailand. I don't think Thailand will end its monarchy anytime soon. I think none of these protesters are calling for the end of the monarchy. They're just calling for reform of the monarchy. So we'll see what happens. But, I mean, I do think monarchies can play an important role, especially in acting as a figurehead and for, people to rally behind. Their neighbors next door, Cambodia, they'd actually they'd gotten rid of the monarchy, and then in 1960, I think that was when the monarchy ended. And then after they were very unstable for a long time, they had the Khmer Rouge and all the horrible stuff that happened there, and then they actually decided to restore the monarchy. So as a symbol of unity for the Cambodian people. And just as one interesting thing about the Cambodian king is that a number of candidates, they have to be members of the royal family that are put forward to become the king, and then a council will select the king. So it's not like what you normally think, where this first in line to the throne and they automatically will become the king or the queen. In Cambodia, there's actually a selection process for the new monarch.
Interesting stuff. I think there's another interesting thing about Thailand, which is, of course, despite this instability, despite the fact that they have less freedom of speech and probably less political stability than us, I believe it was in 2018, they actually passed South Africa in GDP per capita, which I think kind of shows what a place we're in. Terence, you reminded us before the show that it's not just foreign kings who have a lot of power, but we actually have an absolute monarchy next door.
Yeah, we have an absolute monarchy, and then a sort of I suppose what you can call a constitutional monarchy, the first in Eswatini and the other in Lesotho. Eswatini is a showcase, I think, of what bad absolute monarchy looks like. Very limited political and civic freedoms. An economy that's tanking, and a sort of ruling clique that can really live it up. Lesotho's got its own problems. But an interesting thing there, I used to work with a guy from Lesotho, highly, highly educated, a very modern person. And I wrote a piece about Swaziland, as it was called, and I asked for his opinion. And he read through it and he said, you know, what you seem to suggest here is that there's no rational basis to, you know, support hereditary leadership. And he said that, you know, he is a staunch monarchist. He says that he's met the Prime Minister of Lesotho, but the only person he will stand up for in principle is the king of his country. And apparently that is not unusual. Britain, Netherlands, they have monarchies now. And things have been changing in terms of public opinion. But I think a lot of it has to do with once again, we get back to culture, the culture that underpinned the implicit bond between, let's say, the good monarch and his or her people, the idea that, yes, you might live in luxury, but you devote your life to service. And I think you sort of see a new generation of royals who are trying to, you know, live a sort of playboy life and be cool and, you know, get involved with causes that can sometimes be very divisive, as opposed to, you know, accepting those staid traditional duties. Now, you know, maybe that time is passing. I'm not, I don't know. But yes, you know, Thailand is certainly not alone in dealing with these issues.
Morris, you have something to add?
I was going to turn it. You said Eswatini is an example of a bad absolute monarchy. I think all absolute monarchies are pretty bad things. I don't think it's.
You get the UAE, and then sometimes you get Swaziland. And even though neither is a place I'd like to live, I'd rather live in the UAE than Swaziland.
Yeah. But I think you got a point. Monarchies are modernizing, but I do think we've seen people, like I was talking about the King of Thailand, and I think Prince William versus Prince Harry is probably a good example here as well. People do still expect their royal family or people who represent them to have some level of gravitas. I mean, I think if Prince Harry was first in line for the throne and he was getting involved in these various causes and lecturing people about privilege when he's one of the most privileged people on the planet, I don't know how much time the British monarchy would have left. But I think somebody like Prince William is much more measured, and I think he tries to be a modern person, but I think he's much more measured and he's much more aware of the traditions and of the royal family. And I just think, I mean, obviously, I don't know other than, but it just seems to me Prince William seems a bit more of a dignified chap and somebody who's, you know, more a better candidate to become the king of the United Kingdom one day, especially compared to his brother.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. And just for the interest of our listeners, the laws about criticizing the Thai king are such that what Morris has told us about the king now has actually made him. He could be prosecuted for these comments in Thailand if they were ever heard by the Thai authorities. So, Morris, you may have just prevented yourself ever going back to Thailand. And this has actually happened to several tourists. Is if you make any fun of the king, they do arrest you.
I was in Thailand for a week in 2017 and I really enjoyed it. Although all I really saw was 2 days in Bangkok, a couple of islands, and most of the time I was sitting next to a pool drinking. So that was
You might have to change your name and wear a false mustache if you go back. Let's move on to it's a little bit of a weird story, right? So South African singer, actress, dancer, pop star Kelly Kumalo, she recently did a music video for her single Empini. And in the music video, one of the things she did was she dresses up in ancient Egyptian royal clothing and tries to imitate the ancient Egyptian god Bastet, who is the goddess of protection. But as part of this, she darkened her skin. So she looks sort of like her skin, rather than being sort of, I guess, the shade we associate with black skin in South Africa, it's far more like the sort of Sudanese appearance of black skin. And she came under a lot of fire from people on social media, and various others criticized her for essentially engaging in blackface, which is a very strange accusation to hurl at someone who is themselves black. As she said in response to these comments, I knew the criticism would come. I cannot blame them. A lot has happened where black people are concerned. It is such a shame that we see everything as a threat against our skin color, even something as simple as art. I hope one day we get to a point where we see beyond skin color. It's going to take a lot, and I pray to God that we heal from all these things. But having said that, Mpini is simply art. That's her song. So, Maurice, I think I'll go to you. This is kind of a weird story, right? I kind of get the feeling that it sort of suggests that we've lost the plot. The whole reason people got upset about blackface was because it was used in the past to make fun of black people and degrade them. And yet now we've got artists, a black artist, being attacked for being blacker?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, blackface, I mean, I can see why people get offended by it. And I mean, I definitely don't think a white person should go around darkening their skin and trying to pretend to be a black person. But like I said, I mean, Kelly Kumalo herself is black. And I'm sure she was doing this out of a place of respect for Sudanese culture, I assume. I mean, I haven't seen the music video. I obviously don't know too much about Sudanese culture, but I wouldn't think it's her trying to mock the culture or whatever the case is. But I mean, that's the thing when we start breaking down into even small and small identities. Now, I've heard of a thing called colorism, where lighter-skinned black people apparently look down on dark-skinned black people. And it's a thing in India as well. Apparently, people from the south of India who are darker-skinned are often seen as lower class, whatever the case is, or seen as being laborers compared to people from the north of India who've got lighter skin, for example. So I just think it's this, the global culture seems to be going, or South African culture too, I suppose, from this point of view, seems to be going through some kind of a moment of insanity. Because but also to be fair, like you can see what the environment's like at the moment. You'd think that she could maybe have, it's the same as the Clix ad with the hair. Like, you can never discuss whether it's racist or not, but you know it's going to upset people and it's going to cause trouble, which you don't really need to do. So she should maybe have been advised better, but also think like it's actually insane that she's being accused of blackface when she's black herself. How can a black person dress up in blackface? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe if it was Justin Trudeau, she would have got away with it, but it doesn't actually.
So I guess this is one of those stories that's just incredibly 2020, right? People being angry about something, some kind of vaguely race-related, race-related outrage on the internet. Terrence, Is Twitter going to be the collapse of civilization? Because I take it that most of the complaints.
Well, I don't know. Look, Twitter. Where strange things happen. The great sewer where nuance and debate goes to, not so much die as be tortured to death. I remember a couple of years ago, there was two girls at Stellenbosch who painted themselves up as aliens with purple face, and they got into trouble for that. And apparently when they were sort of hauled into the diversity office, there was this enthusiastic guy there who had already typed out their apology, acknowledging that, how devastating dressing up as aliens with purple face and little antennae were to everyone. I don't know. I shake my head. I think that if we are serious about trying to find some resolution to this, about trying to address legitimate concerns and whatever, and I don't really believe for the most part we are. I think we've sort of entered this condemnation culture where the goal is not to resolve our problems, but to keep them aflame and to keep to keep bitterness going. Then there needs to be some recognition that not all of this is done out of spite or malice, and there can be benign explanations sometimes. And sometimes you are just pretending to be an alien. Sometimes you're pretending to be a figure out of Egyptian mythology. One thing I can say, though, I think that for most people, to have someone from what is recognizably a different culture sort of taking on your own attributes, there's almost a sense of pride in that. There was a case in America a few years ago where a young lady was going to her promenade dance and wore this sort of Chinese dress, and someone got upset in social media. My culture is not your damn prom dress. Apparently, she got a great deal of support from people in China, from Chinese people, saying, "Oh, you know, this is wonderful, and you look beautiful in this, and we're very happy that you're enjoying it." And if we want to talk about original blackface, here's a little anecdote. Al Jolson, known as the King of Blackface, Jewish American actor from the early 20th century. If you look at blackface, invariably he sort of comes up. But he was known at the time for being one of the very few Hollywood stars, white Hollywood stars, who actually had genuine affectionate relationships with black actors. You know, he would the big thing at the time. You know, he would entertain black people at his house, and he was by all accounts, you know, greatly respected. Now you may look back and say it's all cringeworthy now, but understand that it came out of a particular context. Just like Muscala's video, it comes out of a particular context, and it's not necessarily venal.
Indeed. I think we're going to have to call it a close there, but I think Terence's point is a good reminder that history is often far more complicated than people would like to make it. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow on The Daily Fringe Show. Have a great week, everyone.